Yeah, thank you for the lovely introduction. It's always a pleasure to be back at Perimeter, but especially a pleasure to be at this conference in honor of someone I truly admire, and to see the very nice distribution in the room today. This is very heartening. So today I'm going to tell you about two recent papers that I wrote together with one with Ahmed Al-Mahiri, Don Maroff, Henry Maxfield. This appeared in May. And one more recent paper with Chris Akers and Daniel Harlow, which I believe appeared in October, if I'm remembering correctly. Fairly recent, maybe September. And the general subject, as you might have guessed from the title, is evaporating black holes in anti-de Sitter space. So I want to begin with a little bit of motivation about evaporating black holes, and then later I'll talk a little bit about the motivation for evaporating black holes in ADS. I think some of you may already be starting to wonder, well, do black holes in ADS really evaporate? Not to worry, I'll discuss that. So let me begin with the motivation for this conference, the structure of quantum space-time. I would say that one of the biggest hurdles to understanding the behavior of gravity on quantum scales is the information paradox. It certainly is not the only problem that we have to deal with, but it is a major one. Understanding what quantum gravity does on these quantum, what gravity does on these quantum scales, understanding the emergence of space-time, if it is emergent, understanding the dynamics of quantum gravity, all of those ingredients go into the black hole information paradox. So this is something which, if we can solve it, is going to inform us a lot about what quantum gravity does on these scales, how it evolves certain data, and what do we really mean by emergent space-time? So there's a lot of reason to want to understand the information paradox. And of course, as theoretical physicists, whenever we find a paradox, it's initially very exciting because it means that there's something going on that's wrong in our way of thinking. And if we just understand it, then we're going to stand to really gain a lot and understand the theory much better. Now, I think we've sort of passed that point with the information paradox. It's not exciting anymore. It's just really irritating. We haven't understood it, and it's been many, many years. And sort of the progress of the information paradox, the way that things work, is there's usually some kind of a breakthrough and a burst of excitement, and then there's long periods of boredom. And I believe it was Joe Polchinski who once told me that theoretical physics is short periods of excitement punctuated by long periods of boredom. And I think that's pretty much the history of the information paradox. Nonetheless, I think we're actually in a we're sort of starting to be in another one of those exciting phases where we are starting to discover and understand a lot. And so this is roughly what this talk is about. Now, let me just recall a couple of things about the black hole information paradox. Unfortunately, this is too small for you to read, but it says Alice falling down the rabbit black hole, but the rabbit is scratched out. So the basic premise, you have Alice and Bob who are entangled, and Alice ends up inside the black hole, and Bob does not. Bob survives to the asymptotic future. Now, if our black hole then evaporates, we end up, naively at least, it would appear, in a mixed state. So if Alice and Bob started out in a pure state, and then Alice fell into the black hole disappeared, all we have left is Bob, and Bob without Alice is very sad in a mixed state. And so this would appear to contradict unitary time evolution. So here, in a nutshell, is the basic ingredients of the black hole information paradox. Of course, there is a lot more subtlety to it than that, but this is the general idea. Now, if we expect that quantum gravity is unitary, which I do, and you may not, and that may be a discussion for another time, but if we accept that general premise, if we work within that premise, then information has to somehow be conserved. We're not going to get information loss if quantum gravity is unitary. And in this sense, ADS-CFT, which I'll discuss in a moment, if you subscribe to it, gives an answer to the question, is it mixed? Is it pure at the end? Well, it has to be pure because information is conserved and evolution is unitary. Now, the reason that I say ADS-CFT gives an answer is that we can think of ADS-CFT as a formulation of non-perturbative quantum gravity. So ADS-CFT is a duality between quantum gravity with ADS boundary conditions and a conformal field theory. And in principle, this duality is supposed to hold at essentially any value of the coupling. So this, any answer we can get from the CFT about quantum gravity in ADS, in principle, tells us about the evolution, about the behavior of quantum gravity. You may protest that we don't live in ADS, so do we care about understanding quantum gravity in ADS? And my answer is, if we can understand the information paradox in ADS, then I think we've made a lot of progress towards understanding it more generally. So there's a sense in which we already know the answer, at least if we're working within quantum gravity in ADS, which has a CFT dual. The answer is that—
I agree with that premise, yeah. Except that unless you use something very peculiar about ADS, which is not there.
Absolutely, I agree with that, yeah. So we have to be careful and make sure that there are universe, that we're working with features of ADS, which we expect to be universal in general. But of course, if we use something that's very special to ADS, well, we may have some other issues. I would still say that if we can figure out one mechanism by which the information can get out of a black hole, even if it uses something special about ADS, that still teaches us a lot about quantum gravity. So this answer, though, just information is conserved with no explanation, this is very unsatisfactory. If we're going to make progress towards understanding the quantum structure of space-time, we need to know more than just what the answer is. We need to know how to arrive at it from quantum gravity dynamics. We need to understand how quantum gravity manages to conserve the information. What are the dynamics that get the information out? How is it that the radiation ends up in a pure state? Not just that it does. Certainly the fact that it does, at least within this paradigm, is very useful, and it gives us an answer to this question, but it's not an answer which has a lot of utility for us. If we really want to understand quantum gravity, we want to understand the information paradox, we need to understand what are the dynamics of quantum gravity, what is the mechanism that solves this problem. So a little bit of background on the information paradox. This is a caricature which I hope you don't hold it against me if you work on this, because it's missing a lot of ingredients. It's just a bit of a flavor. So we have some black hole with temperature larger than the ambient temperature. So if we're in a vacuum, just black hole with some temperature, it's going to radiate, grow progressively hotter, and eventually it's going to evaporate. I had to put the word explodes here because Hawking's original paper was titled Black Hole Explosions, which is sort of fun. So here we have a picture of an asymptotically flat evaporating black hole. Here we have Alice, and you have these two entangled modes across the horizon. If you look at an early time slice or even a mid-time slice over here, the quantum state on this is pure if we prepare the pure from the black hole from a pure state. But up here, since Alice has disappeared and Bob has survived, it would appear that we have a mixed state. So this is just a very rough sketch of the basic ingredients in the black hole information paradox. Now, a diagnostic of what's going on here is the entropy of the radiation, of the Hawking radiation. So I'm going to call this S rad. So rad here just refers to the radiation. And I may at some point later in the talk refer to it as S out, with apologies for that. So let's assume that at sigma zero, the state of the quantum fields in our space-time is pure. So everything, we just start out with a pure state. So here is sigma zero. Now, the state on sigma prime over here is either pure if quantum gravity is unitary and information gets out, or it's mixed and information is lost. So the question is, since we know if we make this an ADS black hole and we know that in ADS CFT the information is conserved, then the question is, well, how is it that we start out with this pure state and we end up with what looks like it should be a mixed state and somehow it's not mixed, somehow it's pure? So one other point here, which is I've drawn this slice here to be at the point where half the black hole has evaporated, so that the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy of the black hole and the entropy of the radiation are equal. And this is known as the page time, so I'll just be using that time t page for several of my figures. So again, this is just the basic setup here. And so here's what happens to the entropy of the radiation up until the page time. So the entropy of the radiation is going to increase as the black hole, so the black hole initially, there's no radiation, we just have a vanishing entropy. Eventually, the black hole starts to radiate, modes are entangled across the horizon, we have a situation where the entropy increases. Again, until it reaches the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy of the black hole at the page time. What happens after the page time depends on whether our quantum gravity theory is unitary or non-unitary. So if the evolution is unitary, then as the black hole continues to radiate, the radiation purifies. Eventually, we end up with the pure state of the radiation. Once the black hole is completely evaporated, all that's left is the radiation. If the final state is pure, then we end up with zero entropy, again, zero von Neumann entropy. If the evolution is non-unitary, then the entropy, there it is, S out, this is just S rad. The entropy S rad continues to grow until the black hole finishes evaporating, reaching a mixed final state. So that would be a figure that looks more like that, sort of asymptoting over there. So whether our quantum gravity theory is unitary or not is diagnosed in some sense by this so-called Page curve. So this curve over here of the radiation is what we call the Page curve. And when the Page curve looks non-unitary, which is to say it continues increasing past the Page time over here, then we say that's the Hawking curve, because that's Hawking's calculation of the entropy, which gives you a mixed final state.
So, I mean, there are two issues. One is that you sort of are postulating that the diagram, the Hawking, the previous diagram that you had, which Hawking drew first, is the physically correct diagram. So.
Oh, I completely agree with you, and I will discuss whether, the second half of my talk will be all about discussing why do we even think, what makes us believe that that's a correct diagram when we really know that non-perturbative quantum gravity effects have to kick in? So that's going to be the second half of the talk.
Okay. Yeah. And the second point was that you just mentioned that, well, our quantum gravity theory, but the Page time is really when the mass, black hole problem, solar mass has gone to half of solar mass. Mm-hmm. It's a very macroscopic black hole.
Sure.
So most people would think that this is really semi-classical gravity, and what really has not much to do with full quantum gravity.
Well,
but you're taking a different point of view. So, but I think that this is a bold point of view to take that.
So
half a solar mass, it's not a.
I don't think that we can possibly hope to model the black hole evaporation without non-perturbative quantum gravity.
I agree, but the question is at which stage.
And I think we don't know the answer to that. It can be, certainly at early stages we expect that semi-classical gravity holds. And we expect that most likely it holds up to the Page time. But it's clear that at the Page time, if this is what's going to happen, then non-perturbative quantum gravity effects have to become important. We can have a philosophical debate on that, but
not philosophical, physics debate, but
we can have an opinion. We can have an argument on that. I'm going to agree with you that there's a sense in which the semi-classical expansion of the metric around some fixed background if you do an expansion of the metric with quantum corrections around a fixed background, I tend to agree with you that seems like it works around the Page time, that we can approximate space-time as still being something that roughly exists and isn't just some quantum mess. I tend to agree with you, but that doesn't mean that you don't end up getting corrections that are exponentially suppressed in the coupling that nonetheless change what's going on, for example, in the Page curve, that contribute to the entropy in a non-trivial way. All right, so what we're going to do is we're going to use ADS-CFT as a tool. Now, the reason that I want to use ADS-CFT is because ADS-CFT is, as I said before, a formulation of quantum gravity. And if we're going to address the black hole information paradox, we are not going to be able to do it using purely semi-classical considerations. There's clearly something going on here which is non-perturbative, which is the black hole evaporation. So to recap, ADS equals CFT, that's the naive way that we market this. It's a duality between quantum gravity with ADS boundary conditions and conformal field theory in one lower dimension. And this means that the CFT gives a formulation of non-perturbative quantum gravity. And I want to say this is a conjecture, it's not proven. Nonetheless, there's a lot of evidence in favor of it. And I couldn't help but mention that Noether's theorem is actually one of those pieces of evidence. The Hamiltonian of GR is a boundary term, which is the Hamiltonian of the CFT. So this is not really necessary for this talk, but given whom this conference is named after, I wanted to just mention this. So the general idea is to pose the black hole information problem in a context where we can get some handle on the quantum gravity dynamics. So we want to study black hole evaporation in ADS using some crucial ingredients of ADS-CFT. Because if we just study quantum gravity, if we just study black hole evaporation in ADS without using the dual CFT, then, well, we're just doing semi-classical gravity and haven't put in any quantum gravity ingredients. All right, so let's talk about the black hole information paradox in ADS CFT. So here I have a black hole which is collapsing, and it's asymptotically ADS, unlike before where it was asymptotically flat. Now, it's the same problem as before, except now we know the answer, as long as we are working within the paradigm of ADS CFT. The evaporation process must be unitary because the CFT evolution is unitary. All right, again, this gives us the answer, but not how we get it. So I often tell my students they don't get any credit if they just put the answer down without showing the work of how they got it. So I think same situation applies here. We don't get any credit unless we figure out how this actually happens in the bulk. So then this is what I wanted to mention before and didn't and alluded to, but now I'll talk about it. Do ADS black holes evaporate? So it's often said that black holes in ADS do not evaporate because the radiation is simply reflected off of asymptotic infinity back to the black hole. So the black hole just achieves equilibrium and it doesn't evaporate. Now, this is true for large ADS black holes, large compared to the ADS radius. Small black holes do evaporate. So it seems, okay, maybe we can make some progress on that front. Unfortunately, we actually don't understand small black holes very well in ADS CFT. There is a recent paper by Don Merrill, I guess not so recent, from last year, which makes some progress towards that goal in terms of understanding small black holes via the microcanonical ensemble. Nonetheless, the bulk of our understanding comes from large black holes. We've studied those much more. We understand them much better. They are simpler. So it appears we're at an impasse. The things that we understand don't evaporate, and the things that we don't understand do evaporate. So I like to refer to this as conservation of misery.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
When you think about the small black holes, do you think of young small black holes or old small black holes? Because they have different properties.
Yes, they have different properties, and I would like to say that we don't really understand any of that in ADS CFT. So we have a real problem with small black holes. We really don't understand what they do, which is why I'm going to work with large black holes. So there does exist a version of the information paradox for large black holes, which is more complicated in terms of correlation functions at late times. It's not as viscerally disturbing. I don't find it as viscerally disturbing because it's a paradox, but in some sense it takes a lot of work and technical details to see it. It's not in sort of the same very appealing or disturbing way that the black hole information paradox comes about for small black holes or in flat space. So how can we model black hole evaporation in ADS? So this is now based on work with Ahmed, Don, Henry, and also there was work at that appeared the same day we coordinated with Jeff Pennington. So if the issue preventing black holes from evaporating is the reflecting boundary conditions at infinity, let's just change the boundary conditions. So here we have an example. So we have some black hole. And what we've done here is we've taken a reservoir. So this is just some conformal field theory living in flat space. And we have, and after at some time, we've coupled our bulk system, our asymptotically ADS system, to this reservoir. And the reservoir is at a lower temperature. So what happens is the black hole is allowed to radiate into the reservoir. So this is a way of saying if the reflecting boundary conditions are the issue, let's get rid of them. And instead, we're going to force the black hole to evaporate by coupling it to a lower temperature system. And one way to think about this is to just say, okay, we have some CFT on flat space, and really we're just putting transparent boundary conditions at infinity. So, yeah.
Am I not to think of the boundary as conformal infinity? Because I don't really know how to attach things beyond conformal infinity.
Good. So the specific model that we are working with is, and I'll say that in a minute, or actually it's right here. So you hold off on that question for just 1 minute.
Okay.
Jeff worked in a slightly different model where he used a different way of coupling the systems, but what we did is we worked in ADS2 CFT1. So this is two-dimensional dilaton gravity, and the matter fields that we considered are conformal, so conformal field theory. So this means that we can just do a conformal rescaling of asymptotic infinity, bring it a finite distance in, and do the coupling there. So you can attach things now at a finite distance since everything is conformally invariant.
But is this not an example of something which doesn't really go through in four dimensions? And
well, so this is rather universal, actually. So there have been a couple of recent papers showing. So again, Jeff did this actually in higher dimensions. He just used a somewhat different way of coupling the two systems. It was not this exact geometric way of doing it, but actually just, I believe, last night, a paper came out that did this in higher dimensions. So it's not, this is, the thing you worried about earlier, where maybe we're using some very special features of ADS, or in this case, ADS2, and indeed would have been my concern as well, it actually does not manifest here. This, it turned out to be universal. You can do this in general. It's not critical to have a conformal field theory in the bulk, but it means that you can do explicit calculations much more easily. You can still derive qualitative properties which show you the same behavior if you were just assume you have some quantum fields with a UV fixed point.
Just to clarify, so you're saying that you're, so normally we think of conformal infinity in GR as points at which the metric, you know, you're, in the real physical metric, it doesn't exist there.
Mm-hmm.
And the conformal factor does something funny at that point.
Yes.
So now you're saying that actually you're not looking at conformal infinity, you're looking at some boundaries within the space-time, ADS space-time.
Well,
and
so
you've got a reservoir.
I'm conformally rescaling infinity, and I've got a reservoir. If you don't want, you don't have to think of it in this geometric way. If you don't like, you can also think of it as just literally putting a coupling. So you just take the Hamiltonian and you add a coupling in the Hamiltonian, and that allows free exchange.
Okay.
Yeah, if you prefer that, that works just as well. This is actually the way that Jeff did it. All right. So yeah. So as I said before, similar results hold in higher dimensions. This was Jeff Pennington's work. So we specifically work in ADS2 CFT1 because we can do the calculations very explicitly. Jeff was able to instead argue qualitatively that the same results are going to hold in higher dimensions without explicitly doing the calculations. So in some sense, this was very clever. It's nice to see that if you do an actual explicit calculations, you really do get that answer as well. So I'm not going to say too much about the two-dimensional gravity, the computational theory we use. We use dilaton gravity, Jakeev-Teitelbaum gravity. So we have a dilaton, and we have these conformal fields that are in the bulk, and they end up radiating over here. So this is the setup. This is how we force our ADS black hole to evaporate. So what we'd like to do now is to compute the entropy. We want to compute a page curve for this system to see what's going on explicitly. So we want to compute the entropy holographically, because as I said before, we could just calculate the entropy using Hawking's calculation, but of course we would get a mixed state because that's just Hawking's calculation. What we'd like to do is to use holography in some way, because holography is where quantum gravity comes in. Now, in the GH bar goes to zero limit, and including the L string goes to zero limit, we have the HRT proposal for computing entanglement entropy holographically. So this proposal says that and I'm talking specifically about regions of the full boundary, that if you take the full boundary in a higher dimensional space, or you just take a point in this two-dimensional space, although this also applies to subregions, but I'm not going to need that now. So take the state at some moment in time, and you compute the von Neumann entropy of that. This is the boundary state. This is given by the area of a surface, which I'm calling X sub t, over 4 GH bar. So this is the reduced density matrix, or the density matrix of the CFT at boundary time t. And xt is the minimal area surface which extremizes the area. Now, you might say, what do we mean by area in two-dimensional gravity? Well, this is dilaton gravity. What we really mean here is the dilaton. So this here is the what we call a classical extremal surface. Now, as long as the boundary system is evolving unitarily, the t dependence is completely irrelevant. So this, you can just get rid of the t here, and you have this one surface x, which is the surface over here. And this computes the von Neumann entropy of the boundary state. All right, so this is...
We're not looking at a collapsing situation. We're looking at a...
That's right. We're looking at the ADS2. We take an eternal black hole, and we add quantum fields in the back. Yeah. This still allows us the black hole to evaporate, which is the salient part of the problem. Yeah. All right. So here, as I just want to emphasize, this is the GH bar goes to zero limit. And by that, I mean this is the strict classical general relativity limit, which is not going to work for us if we're making the black hole evaporate. We need to include quantum correction. So we need a generalization of the HRT prescription, which includes back reaction due to quantum fields. And this is what we called quantum extremal surfaces. This is work that I did with Aaron Wall several years ago, 5 years ago now. So the statement is the following. The entropy of rho of T, this is the density matrix of the CFT, in perturbative quantum gravity is holographically dual to this quantity. And this quantity, which I didn't write here, is the generalized entropy, is what it's called. So this is the area of this surface plus the von Neumann entropy on one side of the surface plus counterterms plus higher derivative corrections. And here x of t is what we call a quantum extremal surface. So it's a surface which extremizes s gen, which is this whole quantity. So instead of extremizing the area, it now extremizes the generalized entropy. And by extremize, what I mean is if you take the surface and you move it a little bit in any direction, the generalized entropy is going to, the first derivative is going to vanish. So that it doesn't change to first order in perturbations of the surface. So this is the, sort of in some sense, a natural quantum generalization of the HRT proposal, because many of us know and love the idea of taking area and just replacing it by generalized entropy. That's a program of research that was started by Bekenstein and has been very successful at getting results about quantum gravity. So we just did that, and there actually has since then been an argument by Shidong and Aito Levkovitz that this is in fact the correct proposal for holographic entanglement entropy in perturbative quantum gravity.
So
S out is S ran. So right now we're not talking. So this is a general statement. The S out is the entropy on one side of this surface. If this surface happens to lie on the event horizon of the black hole, then it is S rad. Okay, so naively, you might expect that classical and quantum extremal surfaces would generally be right next to one another, maybe some Planck distance apart, as long as we were in the perturbative regime. Since in the perturbative regime, regime 1 over g is going to be much larger than S out. So we expect that S out in some sense, or the renormalized S out, is subleading always. And so that means that clearly, and you should see the word naively here as warning that I'm about to dash your expectations, but clearly it would seem that we're not really gaining anything vastly different by using the quantum extremal surface as opposed to the classical extremal surface, since they must be right next to one another, since the quantity that we are extremizing is really just a small perturbative correction. And if you think this, you would not be in the minority. In fact, I'm embarrassed to say that Aaron and I said this in our paper, but it turns out to be false. So quantum extremality, the issue isn't how to balance A over 4G and S out. The issue is how to balance their derivatives. And the derivatives can actually compete with one another, even when the area over 4G is far, far leading order compared with S out. S out can be changing rapidly, even if S out itself is subleading to A over 4G. And so this means that the location of the quantum extremal surface can be displaced by quite a large amount compared with the classical extremal surface. Because, again, for determining extremality, we're interested in the first order variations. And those can be quite large, even when this is subleading to that. Now, in the evaporating black hole, we, meaning myself and these three folks, as well as Jeff Pennington separately, we find that after the page time, the entropy is changing fast enough that its gradient actually balances out the change in A over 4G, even while the entropy remains subleading. Meaning that there is a quantum extremal surface which is nowhere near a classical extremal surface after the page time. And I'm going to show a diagram of where it is. So there's a quantum extremal surface that we say nucleates, in the sense that it wasn't there classically. There was no classical extremal surface before. And now we have this quantum extremal surface which has nucleated, and it's not near a classical one. Yeah?
Is it can page time be defined as when S out is A over 4G?
So no, because the quantum extremal surface doesn't lie on the event horizon.
Page time is when the entropy outside is
yes.
The entropy.
So the entropy, but you're talking about the entropy of the region outside of the event horizon.
Right.
And here I'm talking about the entropy of the quantum extremal surface, which does not lie on the event horizon.
Where does it lie?
Why does it not?
No, but I'm saying, if you say start with the assumption and the two are close together, right?
Yes.
Which I said is nice. But if I start with that assumption, then S, then A over 4G is the area of the black hole on the event horizon, right?
Well, no. So A over 4G is the area of the quantum extremal surface, and S out is the entropy of the quantum extremal surface. And generically speaking, quantum extremal surfaces do not lie on event horizons. If you assume the generalized second law, for example, generically the entropy on an event horizon is going to be increasing. The generalized entropy will be increasing towards the future, whereas the first order variations of the quantum extremal surface in a null direction have to vanish. So the quantum extremal surface will generally lie inside the event horizon and not on the event horizon.
But how much inside?
Sorry?
How much inside?
Well, that's the question, right? It lies. So the picture I'm going to show you is a little bit misleading because it's going to show the old event horizon as opposed to the new event horizon, but it does lie inside of the event horizon.
So what is the space-time diagram? Because you always had this discussical picture, the eternal black hole picture.
So I think I will get a chance. So you bring up an excellent point, which is one which is addressed in the second paper that I'm hoping to talk about, which is that this diagram that we're drawing, the semi-classical evaporation picture, that's in some sense where the problem lies. So if you just hold off on that question, hopefully I'll answer it by the end of the talk. Okay, so this in the picture, and I said before, is misleading because it makes it look like this is outside, but what's really happened is the event horizon has moved. So this is the old quantum extremal surface. This is the new quantum extremal surface, but again, the event horizon has moved, so it's actually over here now. This is the black hole. Well, there are some complicated dynamics for why that's the case. I'm not going to go into them, but just take my word for it. This quantum extremal surface lies inside of the new event horizon. And so I'm going to show a picture in a second, but this thing over here is nowhere near a classical extremal surface. And this jump, so initially what happens at early times, and that's this picture over here, at early times, you have this classical extremal surface is a quantum extremal surface. And as we evolve forwards in time on the boundary, so these are surfaces, extremal surfaces for a boundary region, as we evolve forwards on the boundary a little bit, what ends up happening is that this quantum extremal surface moves slightly. Now, at some point later, this here is a shockwave that propagates in as a result of coupling the two systems. So this is prior to coupling. Now we couple the two systems, there's a shockwave, and the event horizon moves in. And what happens as soon as there's a shockwave, a new branch of quantum extremal surfaces nucleates over here. And that branch is nowhere near classical extremal surfaces. Now for a while, these actually do not dominate the holographic entanglement entropy prescription because these have larger generalized entropy than these, and you always take the minimal generalized entropy quantum extremal surface. But after some time, these actually start to dominate. These have smaller entropy than the ones over here, and so the quantum extremal surface experiences a jump up to here. And then these just start evolving in this direction, and eventually we lose control of the approximation because we're really getting into the deep quantum gravity regime. Okay, so the quantum extremal surface, it turns out, gives a unitary page curve. The entropy goes up until this jump in the quantum extremal surface. It goes up until the transition, and then it decreases afterwards. Now, a direct computation of the entropy gives what we call a Hawking curve. That's just exactly the same as Hawking's calculation and ignores any holography. And what we get is that the entropy goes up and it eventually saturates. So this is saying information loss, and this is saying if we use holography, then we get some kind of an information conservation. Now, this is, of course, to be expected. This is just Hawking's calculation. What about the former? What about this picture over here? Well, the Hawking curve, again, is expected. We're doing the semi-classical calculation and the same one that Hawking did. We get the same answer, a mixed state. The unitary page curve is also expected. We're working in a unitary quantum gravity theory. Or are we? So this is now finally starting to address your point. The dynamics of this theory are not unitary because semi-classical gravity is not unitary. This is what Hawking showed. So whatever quantum gravity magic happens to conserve the information can't happen in this model because we are evolving the system via semi-classical gravity. So we're drawing the semi-classical picture. We're computing the quantum extremal surface, but the system itself, the dynamics of the system, it's going to be non-unitary because we haven't put in quantum gravity dynamics. We're forcing the dynamics to be something semi-classical, and then we're just computing the quantum extremal surface. So the unitary page curve from the quantum extremal surface is what the system would do if it were genuinely holographic. But It's just an approximation to some holographic system, which is why the exact calculation of the entropy yields a non-unitary, you can't see the last few words here, a non-unitary page curve. So what's going on here is our system, it's trying to approximate a holographic system, but because we've put in these semi-classical dynamics by hand, that's not what we're going to get if we do a direct calculation. So if we're going to make progress here, we need to take the lessons that we've learned from what these quantum extremal surfaces are doing, and we need to find a model in which the same kind of dynamics show up, which is actually incorporating some real quantum gravity dynamics, or at least try to find a way of modeling that.
The word semi-classical is used in different senses. So what is your notion of semi-classical?
So what I mean here is that we're writing down an action, in this case, the JT gravity action. And we're assuming that that action is going to be valid everywhere where we're doing the evolution.
And you're not solving, when you say you're solving some equations.
We're solving the equations of motion.
On back reaction using expectation rather than stressing.
Exactly, and that's very semi-classical.
Okay.
Yeah.
And this quantum extremal surface.
Yes.
Somehow you enter something. Is it just a dynamical horizon which is foliated by?
It is not a dynamical horizon.
So what is it foliating? What is it?
So it's not foliating anything. Each one of these is an independent codimension two surface, with the analog. The classical analog is just vanishing expansion in the K and L directions.
Both directions.
Both directions.
Good, thank you.
Yeah. This here is a vanishing quantum expansion.
Right.
All right. So here is a model instead of the non-perturbative quantum gravity dynamics. And I'm going to spend, I think, maybe probably the rest of this talk, which is not that much time, explaining what this model is and motivating why we have these smiling pairs of pants here. So we want a toy model. So really, we just want a toy model for understanding how non-perturbative quantum gravity behavior, such as, for example, dynamical topology change, might model the same type of behavior we saw with the quantum extremal surface, this unitary page curve, this jump into quantum extremal surface. All that seems like features of this system, which is approximating a holographic system, but isn't quite it. All of those are features that we want to preserve here. So this model here, which I'll explain what this is doing in a moment, is motivated by the ER equals EPR conjecture, which is essentially the statement that entanglement builds space-time or it builds wormholes. So here we have a toy model where we imagine that instead of radiating Hawking quanta, we're radiating black holes. So if a black hole is radiating small black holes, this is a good model thanks to ER equals EPR because we say, if you sort of radiate a black hole, you create one of these Aston-Rosen bridges, then you would expect this is essentially identical to entanglement between the, again, we put in parentheses, Hawking radiation and the original black hole. So let's take a look at what's going on here. The dynamics are as follows. At every moment we prepare, every moment in time, so these are constant time slices, we prepare a state with this some non-trivial topology. So you have the original black hole.
Time is going down here or?
So time is this arrow.
Oh, okay.
These are time steps. This is a toy model. So I'll say a little bit about how we might go from this to a full model, which involves more like a quantum wormhole. These might be Planckian. But for now, let's just talk about this purely classical picture. So here we have, so each one of these is one time step. And we imagine a situation, you have a large black hole, and every time there's a Hawking, it radiates a Hawking quantum, we get another one of these little wormholes. So we start out with a black hole, maybe just a couple of Hawking quanta have been radiated, and we look for the extremal surfaces. Yeah.
So what's the dimensionality of space-time here?
So this is in three dimensions, three bulk dimensions. Yeah. Yeah, so we can actually prepare each one of these states from the Euclidean path integral. So we can write down the state at every moment in time. The thing we can't write down is the Hamiltonian, which evolves you from this to that. Because they say that's not perturbative quantum gravity, we're sort of modeling it in this way. But we, at every moment in time, we can write down the state, and we know what the CFT dual state is. Yeah.
So the asymptotic structure at each time is modifying.
That's right. Yeah.
The asymptotic.
So every time you gain an additional asymptotic infinity. Yeah.
Okay.
So that means it's a dynamical topology change, and I actually think that there is a Schottky disk which actually prepares this type of which interpolates between these two systems. So it has like seven handles, and you can actually go back and forth between the three and the four. So there's some kind of a transition amplitude between these in the Euclidean path integral. Okay, so let's just take a look at what the extremal surfaces are doing. So here we have a, this is an extremal surface. This is just the bifurcate horizon of the large black hole, the one that's radiating. And each one of these are the bifurcate horizons of the small ones. Now, initially, the area of this is much larger than the sum of these areas. So we say, okay, this is the union of these is the quantum extremal surface, which is the which computes the entropy of this black hole. Eventually, though, we radiate enough that there are enough of these that the area of the union of all of these is actually larger than the area of that. And when that happens, we get a jump in the extremal surface. So at this point, this starts to dominate instead. And this is a completely analogous to the jump that we saw in the quantum extremal surface at the page time. And when we look at what the curve that we get, this is exactly the curve we recover from this. So we have this initial increase in the entropy. And then once the jump happens, once we jump from this extremal surface to this one, we then get a sharp decrease in the entropy. So we fully recover a unitary page curve using these dynamics, which admittedly are, in some sense, very toy model-esque. But nonetheless, these are motivated by ER equals EPR. They have the same features as the semi-classical model while actually incorporating features of non-perturbative quantum gravity. And they recover for us the unitary page curve. So the main feature that we've put in by hand is the fact that it's how we're evolving from one state to the next. And nonetheless, each of these states in the middle, each one of these, we know how to prepare, and we know that it has a CFT dual. So this is just some Hamiltonian that we prescribed that goes from one CFT state to the next. So we can, in principle, write this down. All right, so I'm going to now wrap up since I got my few-minute warning. So understanding the black hole information paradox is of paramount importance for understanding space-time and space-time emergence in quantum gravity. This is an outstanding problem for many decades now, and I think we're back to the point where we're making some serious progress, although in some sense we never really stopped making progress on this. Now, ADS-CFT provides a very tractable way of modeling black hole evaporation within quantum gravity. I'm not going to say that we have solved the problem. We have not solved the problem, but we have made a lot of strides towards starting to address this problem and identified what are the features that we expect from a quantum gravity description of the evaporation. This jump into quantum extremal surface is very important and crucial. And some things I didn't really get a chance to talk about today is certain decoding protocols that are very explicitly realized by this jump in the quantum extremal surface. Now, modeling this evaporation, assuming semi-classical gravity in the bulk, does get us into a bit of trouble. Because again, we know that really semi-classical gravity, these equations of motion, don't give us unitary evolution, but it gives great inspiration for how quantum gravity might solve the problem. Again, this jump into quantum extremal surface, that shows us how we can reproduce the page curve and also works with the so-called Hayden-Preskill protocol. So this tells us, even though this calculation, strictly speaking, in semi-classical gravity is really not telling us about what quantum gravity is doing, it's informing us a lot about what it should do and how it might actually go about resolving the problem. Now, we need to understand better how and whether the toy model is actually describing quantum gravity dynamics. Of course, we don't expect that this large classical wormholes actually form. We really expect that these are quantum analogs, quantum wormholes, quantum connections. These are Planckian-sized. And indeed, there's some work towards this. So it is, in some sense, possible to write down transition amplitudes within the path integral that interpolate between these two different topologies. There's a non-zero amplitude for going from this three-boundary wormhole to a four-boundary wormhole to a five-boundary wormhole, and so on. So as long as the smaller the wormholes are, the better the transition amplitude is, the larger it is. So it certainly seems that we might actually be able to understand this from quantum gravity dynamics using the path integral. I think there are many exciting developments yet to come. We're in a very exciting era in this field of black hole information paradox. So do stay tuned, and thank you very much for your attention.
From the perspective of your CFT, where you want unitarity to hold,
yes.
all of a sudden you've got things popping up which are more CFTs,
mm-hmm.
more boundary states.
Yeah.
And this CFT cannot communicate to the other one.
No.
Except by the Einstein-Rosen bridge.
No.
So where is it that you get, so let me just finish
yeah, yeah,
the question.
Yeah.
Where is it that you start off at one state with
mm-hmm.
the idea of having unitarity? How is it that you would recover unitarity by having many more boundaries
mm-hmm.
that are created every second or whatever?
Yeah, yeah. So the way we do this is the following. So you imagine that you have this black hole over here, and you have these CFT states, or those over there, that exist prior to the formation of the wormhole. And then you couple this boundary CFT to that one that forces the black hole to evaporate. This coupling allows the two CFTs to communicate, so to speak. And the entropy that she's conserved is the entropy of all of the CFTs together. So that is the state that we're considering.
But still amusing, but I mean, is it not like just baby universes?
Yeah,
these are not. This is no, but these are not baby universes, right? These are connected. These are not baby universes. It's very important. Baby universes will give you information loss.
That's a technical. Okay.
Yeah.
That's a technical distinction.
Steve, you have a
question. So, this looks like it would give a beautiful answer if you assume that the quantum extremal surface really gives you the entropy.
Mm-hmm.
But that still doesn't give a bulk picture of how the radiation is purifying. Does it suggest anything for that?
Yes. So in this example here, we actually, for every state, we can actually compute the entropy using the Euclidean path integral. So these are states which can be prepared by a certain construction on the Schottky disk, and we can actually compute the entropy using the Euclidean gravitational path integral. So it's true that the Euclidean path integral knows more about quantum gravity than it has any right to, and we don't really know why that is. So therein lies the mystery, in a sense. But there is an explicit procedure. We don't have to assume in this example that the quantum extremal surface is actually calculating the entropy, because we can prove it in this particular example. We can prove it from the Euclidean path integral. Why the Euclidean path integral knows about it, that's a question we don't know how to answer yet.
Okay.
Yeah.
And last question.
So the idea, as I understand from earlier, is you have this classical surface that evolves and it jumps to the quantum extremal
mm-hmm.
surface, right? For this black hole. But there's a paper, I think about half a dozen years old, by Alhiri and Sully, where they looked at the CGHS black
mm-hmm.
hole and showed that it's actually a remnant. Now, I know it wasn't ADS, but you could imagine adapting it to it. So what would happen? I mean, at least it shows there's an example where you can have a remnant. So what will happen to this in the case there are such things?
So such things are not going to be accommodated by this model. And unfortunately, the explanation is not super intuitive, so perhaps I should take it offline. But they wouldn't be accommodated by this model. This is sort of the very short answer.
Great. Let's thank Anita for her excellent talk.